Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hi, I'm Angela Heathcote and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Social media has recently been flooded by images of the Amazon burning. But what a lot of Australians don't know, we have one of the worst land clearing rates in the world. Today, I'm speaking with Rebecca Spindler. Rebecca is on the front lines of the deforestation crisis in Australia. So I'm really excited to hear what Rebecca has to say on this topic on today's episode of Talking Australia. Thank you so much for being with me, Rebecca.
Thank you for inviting me. It's lovely to chat.
Now, lately we've been hearing a lot about deforestation because of the fires in the Amazon. Now, I guess being an Australian, looking at that, it's devastating. But in Australia, we have a deforestation crisis here as well. So I'm wondering if you can kind of just initially map out the similarities between what's going on in the Amazon and what's going on here in Australia.
Sure. I mean, I think it's a much more complicated mosaic of issues. There's deforestation and then there's the fires. There's no doubt that fires are becoming worse, less predictable, earlier, later than they ever have been before. And that is partly due to climate change. That climate change is exacerbated by deforestation. And that's happening at two different levels. Government facilitated, allowable, legal deforestation, and then illegal forestation. And both are happening in both Australia and Brazil. So what we're finding is certainly in Brazil, the government is facilitating burning of the Amazon forest to facilitate agriculture, farming, conversion into farming. It's a very natural human response to go into an area that looks lush and productive and it's full of trees and full of really lovely growing things and think, great, I'll cut that down because it looks great and fertile and I'll be able to grow a fantastic crop there. In the case of the Amazon, and as is the case with a lot of Australian soils, that is simply not the case. You actually find the greatest biodiversity, the greatest diversity of all life in the harshest environments because each new species is trying to find a new niche to fill. It's a new way of getting resources. So we have the same sort of thing in southwest WA, the greatest floristic diversity in the world. This is an incredible biodiversity hotspot. It's been knocked down. There's patches of deforestation all the way through that area to build crops, to build farms. And yet to call this stuff soil is generous. You know, it's really sand. It's glorified sand. The high rainfall rate in that area has just washed all of the nutrients of the soil out in that area. So as we try and reforest some of that area or rebuild the biodiversity, the floristic diversity of that area, it's the toughest job I've ever seen. You know, it's you have little scrubby plants that have been planted 5, 6, 7 years ago that are just struggling to find the nutrients back in that soil. The same is true of the vast majority of the Amazon. It just isn't as fertile as it looks. It just took centuries and centuries for those trees to grow as tall as they are. So by knocking them down, not only do we lose the biodiversity in those trees and the habitats for so many of the animals in these incredible biodiversity hotspots, to try and restore that, to try and rebuild that, will take centuries.
Mm. And what were your first reactions when you saw the Amazon burning? What were your first thoughts?
I don't know that I was thinking. I think I was feeling. And it's devastating. It is just absolutely devastating because of the dual effects. You know, not only are we immediately losing that biodiversity, we're losing the services that those areas are providing to the globe. Through the gaseous exchange, by bringing down carbon from the atmosphere into the soil, they are helping us mitigate climate change. They're helping us address climate change. So we're throwing carbon directly into the atmosphere by burning it, and we're stopping the potential of those areas to help us address climate change in the future.
Mm. What I found really interesting about all the reports around the Amazon fires was that I guess a lot of Australians were, you know, upset about it and looking at it thinking, oh, this is the worst thing ever. But I just wasn't so sure whether or not they were aware that similar things happen in Australia. Do you feel that they're aware that similar things are happening, or?
It's a really good question, isn't it? What people know and what they react to. I think there's a huge amount of denial going on across the country and really across the globe. I think people do know. It would be really difficult to avoid the fact that New South Wales, Queensland, Australia is one of the land clearingest areas of the world. You know, we've accelerated the rates of land clearing astronomically over the last few years, and we've been doing a pretty good job, really, for about 50 years. So I think a lot of us are really keen to see what the plan is. When are we going to stop? When are we going to stop land clearing? When there's 10% left, 5%, 2%? The majority of forested areas, treed areas across Australia are either gone, they've been replaced by agriculture, or they're significantly affected. They're significantly impacted and degraded. What's the plan? When are we going to stop that? We know we have so much evidence about the importance of nature and wild areas for human health. The basic human health, hard health in terms of breathable air, pure water, all of those sorts of provisions, the ecosystem services. But also just in terms of mental health, that we know that nature repairs mental health. It provides hope. It helps you make clear and important decisions that are really based much less about your individual short-term gain. It gives you that longer view. People utterly change the way they think after going and doing things like forest bathing or nature adventures and all that sort of thing. There's lots of evidence around that. I've just been at an IUCN meeting over the last 2 days talking about the importance of a healthy environment for healthy people and vice versa. Healthy people, we also need healthy people to help protect that healthy environment and make sure it's functioning, to make sure that we are able to take advantage of all the processes that a healthy ecosystem provides us. But one of the, so you spoke last week to Leslie Hughes about the IPCC. One of the other international panels is the International Panel on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. And Rosie Cooney gave us a summary of that report saying that it's pretty simple. It says it all. We are not on track and everything's going to get worse. So I think everybody's looking for the plan. What is the plan? The Bush Heritage is an extraordinarily boots on ground, solutions-oriented, focused group that are trying to do what we can across the 11.3 million hectares that we care for country. It should be said that the vast majority of that is actually on Indigenous protected areas. So we work with Aboriginal people on their land to protect the cultural and conservation values. We own land ourselves, and we are working our little guts out to try and protect and rebuild function and the healthy processes across those lands. But we can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to be part of what used to be called the National Reserve System. It's no longer supported financially through government, really. So it's the private and public protected area network. We all have to work very, very hard, not only to keep extending the area of protected acreage, but make sure that is healthy, to make sure it's really providing us humans and all species those ecosystem services, making sure that everything's functioning together and we're maintaining those intricate and exquisite relationships between species.
Mm. Do you think there can be comparisons made between the political situation in Brazil and the political situation in Australia, in the sense that no one's really calling it what it is, in a way?
I think it's really hard to draw those sorts of parallels. I think the political situation in Brazil is really extreme. And all I can say is I really hope we don't get to the point where our government is really not willing to listen at all, which is really, I think, where we are in Brazil. And that's devastating to see when I have a really strong connection to Brazil. I used to work there, and the public are, for the majority, incredibly environmentally aware, really wonderful people, and they'll be devastated by what's going on.
Mm. And I want to go into the recent issue of Australian Geographic. We have an article on deforestation in which you feature. I want to go back to the crisis in Australia that you mentioned, those extreme numbers. What is the crisis? How big is it and what's going on?
We have seen some of the greatest land clearing rates in our history and in recent times. And as I say, part of that is illegal and part of that is facilitated by the regulatory framework that we have right now. And I think the most devastating thing is really that trajectory that these international panel reports are telling us around where we're going. The situation is dire right now, but there's still time to stop. You know, if we wake up and we provide a regulatory framework that says, you know what, land clearing is not good for anyone and we need to find a way. One of the really interesting things, I think, is that this land clearing is often facilitated in the name of farmers. And I don't buy that. I think there are some farmers who want land cleared. I think more and more farmers, these are people who live on the land. They understand the connection to nature. They understand, many of them see firsthand the benefits of biodiversity on their properties in terms of the things that they can give them, their productivity, reducing costs. But there's also great things like farm to table and farm to market that help them get a financial benefit from having more biodiversity friendly farms. So I think there's...
Do you think those are niche though? Do you think that overwhelmingly, because obviously this is a contentious debate between farmers and reforestation, deforestation. So is that a few farmers or can you get enough on board for that?
That more and more. So there are actually really some fantastic federal government initiatives for genuinely facilitating farmers to change their practices to be more biodiversity friendly and to have as little impact as they possibly can in terms of reducing pesticides and bringing biodiversity ecosystem services directly to the farm. So it's probably not certainly the majority right now, but it's a growing trend. And we, Bush Heritage, wants to work very closely with farmers to make sure that we're measuring and improving biodiversity values on farms, because we know we all have to work together. I think there's a case for intensive farming in some areas because there really probably isn't an effective way to do some of the farming that we undertake. But we need to pick our crops really carefully. Is cotton a good crop in Australia? Let's ask that question. And let's figure out where we can run intensive farms effectively to be as productive as we possibly can, but where we can also work and have the dual goals of productivity and biodiversity across large landscapes. We fundamentally see that that's possible. There's fantastic research that was also quoted in the article from ANU, the amazing Sue Ogilvie, who's demonstrated that using biodiversity-friendly or regenerative farming techniques, you can not only improve biodiversity, you improve your productivity, profitability, and farmer welfare by using new techniques. And I think there are lots of farmers that are very keen to take that up. And they're the sorts of things that we need to look for. We need to look for those innovative ways of working together. No longer should conservation stand on one side of the fence and farming stand on the other.
Right.
We need to be working hand in hand for the future. And the thing that always gives me hope is that we've done it. You know, Australians, when given the right sort of framework, the right motivation, the barriers are taken away, we turn on a dime. Everybody says you can't turn on a dime, but look at what we did with hydrofluorocarbons. They were eliminated from the market really very, very quickly. That social change by eliminating the barriers and giving people a way forward was all it took. Look at water restrictions. Australians turn on a dime when we're given the pathway forward.
We'll take a quick break and we'll be back with Rebecca Spineler in just a moment. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you will also receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. We're back with our conversation with Rebecca Spindler. I want to go into what you mentioned about the regulatory framework. Now, we know that Australia used to have about 30% of tree cover and now that's been halved. And I know there was a recent report about by the University of Queensland and a bunch of conservation groups that found that something like 7.7 million hectares of threatened species habitat had been cleared since Australia introduced national environment laws. That, to me, is concerning because those laws were introduced to prevent that from happening. So, and this is a debate right now as well, whether or not we should have new environment laws. What's your take on that?
obviously, as an environmental conservation group, we want the strongest possible laws we can for the protection of biodiversity.
But in reflecting on those laws, do you think some people have taken advantage of maybe how lenient or kind of not strong those are?
I think there are two elements to a law. So the first thing is having it, and the second thing is enforcing it. And I'm not a policy wonk. In some ways, I wish I was. I just don't have that brain. But one of the things that would be really interesting in the Protection Act that you're talking about is the Environmental Protection Biodiversity Conservation Act, EPBC Act. That is our strongest federal legislation that we have to protect biodiversity in Australia. And that review has to happen. So by October, November this year, that must have started a review. And we are concerned. It has to be said, with a lot of the rhetoric that's coming out of various circles across Australia, we're really concerned that that policy framework is going to be watered down. In effect, I think it hasn't really been...
Wait, so you think that there's potential it could get worse, as in watered down even more than people say it already is?
Yeah. So one of the things I think that's really important to figure out is whether this policy has been tested properly, and I'm not sure it has, because I don't think it's ever been enforced to its fullest effect. So is it the policy framework that's at fault, or is it the fact that we've never actually enforced it to its fullest effect? And there are some examples that are coming through now. Strangely, you know, there are still some small wins that were the planning department saying no to the Bylong coal mine. That's fantastic, looking at the halting of the rezoning of forests based on evidence that we actually don't have a need for more timber. So there is evidence-based decision-making going on a smaller scale. We would just like to see that elevated at a national scale. So one of the really interesting things that I think I'm hoping is going to come out of the EPBC review, and I know the public servants that are in charge of that EPBC review, and they're wonderful. You know, they're going to do a really fantastic job. We will work with them. All of the conservation NGOs have made a pledge to work with them to provide as much information, evidence as we possibly can. I'd be really interested to see how many times this is the EPBC, and it's called a referral. So when you think someone has contravened that regulation, you get to put in a referral and say, we'd like that to be reviewed. How many times has an EPBC referral stopped a development? How many times has it stopped a mine or, you know, anything that's really going to have a significant impact on the biodiversity in the local area? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's going to be one of the key things that comes out of the EPBC review.
I wanted to touch on something that you said before about the enforcement, because there is a level of regulation there, but it's the enforcing that's the issue. And I know that John Woinarski has touched on there is this framework, but there's almost this inability to, you know, enforce it. There's no responsibility, even when it's very clear who's responsible. What is that? Because if you commit a crime in, you know, against a human, for example, you are punished for that. But when you're responsible for, you know, the degradation of nature or the loss of a species, and we can literally map out that you are responsible, this department's responsible, I mean, why doesn't it apply the same? Why is it different?
It's an excellent question. It's a question for the ages, I think, really. But,
that was a hard question, so I'll give you some leniency with this one.
But my personal feeling is because we don't recognise the value of nature. And I mean that in a ephemeral sort of sense. You know, there's a lot of people that just go about their lives. We are so city-bound. Humans really around the world, and particularly in Australia, we're very urbanised. So we go about our world. It's very easy to forget that we are fundamentally dependent on a functioning natural system. So there's that sort of ephemeral valuing of nature and understanding that we are dependent on it. But we also don't put a monetary value on it. And I know that's a very controversial thing to do, to try and provide a financial figure for the biodiversity.
But some conservation groups have turned to doing that,
yep.
Like with the Great Barrier Reef. And I'm not sure if someone's done it for the Dane Tree, but saying this is how much,
right,
you know, this raises.
This is what we're losing. And I think that's what we need to do increasingly. And I before people start ringing Bush Heritage, I want everybody to understand, I agree. Nature has an intrinsic value, and we will never ever approximate what that is. We will always underestimate what the intrinsic value of nature is. However, what we can do is understand the cost of a particular development, the cost of a particular decision to let something go ahead that is going to destroy a large patch of biodiversity or a particular habitat of a threatened species, say the black-throated finch, and figure out what we're losing with that going forward. What is it going to cost us to replace that in the future? And in so many cases, it's much more than we're able to generate. So when we talk about it's all, you know, the economic health and we'll be able to restore everything as long as we maintain health in the economy, that is increasingly hard to believe because it's going to cost us more and more and more to restore the nature that we destroyed 20 years ago.
I'm wondering what you think of, I guess the role of consequences in these situations. We're talking about the EPBC Act and enforcement. Do you think that, especially when it comes to land clearing, the consequences don't stack up when it comes to, you know, land clearing? And, you know, you can clear this land and get away with it for just a little bit, but then you use it for what you had always intended to. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. And I think that's what comes down to enforcement. So if the EPBC Act was strengthened, and so that the consequences were really significant, but it also has to be resourced. You know, part of the lack of enforcement, honestly, is just the lack of enforcement officers going out there and double checking and monitoring, even through land satellite imagery. Some of it will not take very much, and some of it does actually require boots on ground to go and understand what the impacts of activities out on the ground are. But we need to invest in that because this is important. I think there's a fundamental lack of understanding. Perhaps that's not true. It's not a lack of understanding. It's a lack of action based on that understanding that nature is important. And that's one of the key things that we've been trying to think about in the IUCN just recently around how do we drive action from that understanding? We think a lot of people do understand the importance of nature to human health and mental health and a functioning society and clean air and clean water and all of those sorts of things, the services that nature provide us. So how do we turn that into action to protect that? And what is the long-term goal? I think a lot of people are thinking about making decisions based on not only their own benefit, but their own short-term benefit. What's the benefit to your children and your grandchildren? Try and make decisions based on your grandchildren and what the life that they're going to be living. Stop this short-termism. It's because I think, you know, we look to our politicians not just to win the next election, but to govern and to build us a society that we all want to live in.
And I want to go into Bush Heritage's work in this area because obviously you guys have a massive stake in the fight against deforestation. What are some of the tactics that you guys have?
So we are utterly apolitical. We work really constructively with government to provide them a different way. And that's largely where we've started working with farmers to build a different way of thinking. So it's not farming or conservation, it's farming through conservation, or it's conservation through farming, whichever way you want to think about it. So we work really constructively with governments wherever we possibly can to provide those avenues forward. We also work with partners across the board. So one of our primary groups that we really work very closely with, and we have a great privilege of working with many Aboriginal groups around the country. So as I said, the vast majority of the lands upon which we work are owned by traditional owners, so Indigenous protected areas, and they're amazing. You know, the work that they're able to do, the Aboriginal rangers are fantastic. They're dedicated, they're hardworking, they're fun, you know, they're the cousins I should have had growing up in many ways. Just absolutely phenomenal, dedicated people who have, if ever you feel like giving up, if ever you feel like losing hope, look to them and their stories and you'll see how much they've lost. You'll see how much degradation they've seen across their lifetimes, and they're not giving up. They're out there fighting every single day. And so we work very, very strongly with them. We really work for them on their lands, and we drive our own lands. But where we have properties that we own, we also work with our neighbours really closely. We're part of the community. We manage our land across large landscapes as much as we possibly can to get rid of the threats, to get rid of cats, to get rid of weeds, to control fire. We're tackling a couple of fires up in the north right now, and there are fires that are on our property and there are fires that are on our neighbour's property, and we're out there fighting for everything.
Mm. And do you think, just on the note of Indigenous rangers, we're kind of experiencing this moment, I guess, in Australian history with books like Dark Emu, where Australians are waking up to the knowledge or waking up to the importance of Indigenous knowledge. And I know you guys are kind of, Bush Heritage in a way is really great at enlisting people and making sure that that knowledge is totally intrinsic to your practices. But, you know, do you imagine some of that knowledge being incorporated into maybe the EPBC Act or things like that? Or is that too far?
It's certainly not too far to aim for. I think that's exactly what we need to aim for. Whether we get there, I don't know. We'll have to see how the EPBC Act review goes. But again, just at this IUCN meeting, listening, we had fantastic Aboriginal representation, people doing amazing things out on ground. It was really wonderful to hear their stories directly from them. And one of the things that was from Kerry Arabina, actually, had said, it's great to figure out what we want to do on our individual IPA lands, but let's bring that Aboriginal thinking into a much broader scale. Let's plan across song lines. Let's protect entire rivers. Let's look at an utterly landscape, and by that I sort of mean half of Australia. Yes. Let's look across the landscape and figure out how Aboriginal people saw that, because that's based on knowledge. It's the song lines, the stories are based on thousands of years, tens of thousands of years of knowledge passed down from one generation to another of what worked and what didn't, what's important and where we can be productive, what we can alter and what we can't. Let's bring that in. To ignore that is just stupidity from anything else. It also happens to be the right thing to do to incorporate that knowledge into our national thinking around conservation.
We know that less than half of Australia's remaining native forests are on government-owned land, and it would seem that regulating native vegetation on private properties is very contentious. So I'm wondering what your experiences have been with that and how to get private landholders on board with initiatives with like revegetation and things like that.
Yeah, that's a really great question. So there's and it's not just Bush Heritage, there's a number of NGOs that are all working together. It's really helpful to have a mosaic of approaches to conservation. So we work very, very closely with Greening Australia and Trust for Nature in Victoria and many, many other, the Nature Conservancy, many other conservation agencies. They do their thing, we do our thing, and we meet in the middle. But it's all for the same goal. So someone like Trust for Nature does a fantastic job down in Victoria with a revolving fund. So either land agents, a private land owner, a farmer, might have a little bush block that they want to protect. They put a covenant on it and they're able to gain financially for that, but they're able to then turn that, the TFN are able to turn that over. That Greening Australia doesn't own land itself, but it does a lot of reforestation, which can then can provide carbon credits to the landowners. You know, there's lots of different mechanisms. We go out there, we buy it, we reforest it ourselves, but we also work with our neighbours to make sure that we're building corridors as much as we possibly can. And we find that people are loving it. Landowners, private landowners, are coming to us all the time wanting to build these corridors, wanting to understand and build the best biodiversity they possibly can to have the greatest impact, to have the greatest effect. There are people that want to buy land for us. And then we apply our strategic framework over it and say, okay, if you want to buy land for us, this is where the highest biodiversity is right now and where we think it's likely to be in 50 years' time. Because as well as mitigating climate change, we're building climate change impacts into our planning, because we know it's coming. The environment is already changing. Climate change is here. There's a lot of people that talk about it in the future. It's already here. And we need to figure out where we're going to have the greatest probability of success in 50 and 100 years' time, because we're here forever. We're doing this forever. So when people say, we want to buy land for you, or do you want this piece of land, we have to figure out how it works within our framework so that when we put boots on the ground, we know that those boots are going to have the greatest possible impact in protecting biodiversity forever.
Other than stopping the burning of fossil fuels, the next big issue, or I guess the next big answer to the climate crisis, is planting more trees, having more trees around. And it's interesting that deforestation is, you know, increasing as the climate change crisis is getting worse, as scientists say. What do you think people can do to stay hopeful?
So one of the greatest things I've ever done is actually join Bush Heritage, and I think I was super lucky to get that job. But everybody has access to one of the things that is the greatest source of hope is the Bush Heritage website and our social media. Because we're so boots on ground, we're so solution oriented, those stories are full of reality, but also successes and hope. And so please go to the Facebook, look at our Twitter, go to our blog. I've just written a blog about riding the rails between Melbourne and Sydney, and what a wonderful experience that is. You know, if you've got the time, take the train instead of a plane. Do what you can yourself and revel in those successes. Take those successes as yours. You are, everybody needs to be an environmentalist, and fundamentally we all are an environmentalist. I'm really keen. I know there's a lot of eco grief out there. There's a lot of depression. Be careful with yourselves. There's lots of programs out there, whether it's Beyond Blue or Headspace or the Regenerative Culture. Find your tribe, find your culture and people that you can really live and breathe these principles with and enjoy the successes and love them. My Ultimo community is my tribe, and we're building a sustainable Ultimo. That is the secret to our success, you know, just finding our culture, finding our tribe and loving the successes together. But do what you can and pat yourself on the back, go to a climate strike, you know, just do what you can.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to me, Rebecca.
Thank you so much. It was great.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Rebecca Spindler. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram @AustralianGeographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening. Until next time.